more noticeable from a distance. Deciding it didn't want to spend any more time exposed like this, it hoisted the bag onto its shoulder and trudged off toward its home base. This bag was filled with yet more toolboxes and parts it purchased from Fizzy. The reason it had to carry the items around like this instead of sticking them in its storage was that it had to open its maw in order to fit the large container in its pocket dimension. While it could discreetly deposit and withdraw small objects like a blade blossom or a satchel of gold, no amount of sleight of hand would let the mimic do that with those bulky metal boxes. As for the cost of its new purchases, it came out to a whopping 1,170 GP. A naturally greedy creature like Boxy severely disliked parting with that much shiny gold at once, but it was for the sake of advancing its artificer job, so it couldn't be helped. That money was essentially a form of investment, as the monster stood a very good chance of securing a profit. Most artificer-made devices were difficult to put together since they required specialized parts, tools, and know-how, but the final product was extremely simple to use. As a side effect, the value of such gizmos would go up immensely when compared to the cost of the raw materials to make them. A good example of this was the 100 blade blossom kits the mimic had purchased 3 days ago. The raw materials to produce all those spring-loaded single-use devices only cost Fizzy about 150 GP. She had then used her workshop to transform the metal ingots into tiny blades, springs, wires, and other necessary parts. The finished components were sold to Boxy at a total price of 650 GP, which consisted of 50 GP worth of tools and 600 GP worth of parts. Even then, a single well-made blade blossom from Boxy could be sold at 15 GP. So, it was theoretically possible for the mimic to make almost 3 times as much gold as it had spent on the parts. Unfortunately, reality wasn't anywhere near as rosy as such wishful thinking. Of the first 30 devices that Boxy made, 12 were complete failures, 14 were of poor quality, and only the remaining 4 were of standard quality. And while the next 70 were at least of middling value, only 20 or so of them were as good as the ones it sold at the Mercenary Guild. Whether there was anyone around willing to buy 100 blade blossoms was a different question altogether, though it wasn't something Boxy even considered. In fact, it had already set off a number of the things for testing purposes and put a bunch of them aside for later use. Once its supply of raw parts was exhausted, it began taking them apart and putting them back together in order to acquire more Artificer XP. This new endeavor worked well, but it came at a price since not all of the components could be safely extracted from a finished blade blossom. The petal-shaped razors were mostly fine, but the more delicate internal parts got dented or broken from the repeated strain and were quickly rendered unusable. Boxy assembled a total of 170 blade blossoms before it decided to stop. At present, it only had 15 or so well-crafted ones and 6 crappier ones. It was no longer in a position to recoup its losses even if it were to sell all of those. But that was fine. The main purpose of spending its gold to increase its artificer level was already accomplished. Besides, all the money spent on this endeavor would eventually come back to it since it was an investment. Which, in Mimicanese, meant that when Boxy was done with this city, it would kill the gnome, absorb her body, steal all her money, take every single ingot, spring, sprocket, and nail in her workshop, and then have Zira burn down her house for good measure. That way it would be able to get all of its assets back, and then some. Boxy was, however, completely oblivious to the fact that Fizzy had already used a large chunk of said assets to settle outstanding debts. She'd also had to set some aside to pay taxes and purchase necessities like food, tools, and raw materials. Her pockets were therefore no more full than when the mimic entered her life, but at least she had some semblance of peace of mind. As for the blissfully ignorant shapeshifter, it walked through the city streets in the vague direction of the southern gate for about half an hour. At one point, it went off the main road into a less populated side street, then proceeded through a series of increasingly dingier alleyways until it reached an old, run-down stone and wood building in the middle of the slums. This place was likely a warehouse at some point, considering how large and spacious it was. Boxy went inside through what was once the building's loading entrance. Rotting boxes, bits of rubble, glass shards, a couple of wrecked carriages, and other useless junk was lying strewn about the place. It was also once home to a small community of 16 wretched vagrants. They were so pitiful that the only successful cadaver absorption they yielded was just 2 points of endurance. Merely a drop in the lake that was the mimic's HP at this point. The monster in question proceeded towards a doorway that led farther to the back. This appeared to have once been an office at some point. The old desk, wooden cabinet, broken chairs, and old, musty bookshelves the mimic found when it first entered the place suggested as much. All that garbage had been thrown out since then, though. The room was now completely empty except for 2 dead bodies on the floor, a rusty iron trunk in the corner, and a red-skinned, four-armed demon sitting on top of it with a bored expression.
"Oh, hey, boss,"
said Cora when she noticed her master approach. She got up from her improvised chair and stretched her stiff body with a yawn. The gigantic fiend towering over even Boxy's current form was deemed way too conspicuous to accompany it around town. So she was ordered to guard the place and keep out of sight. Well, the former was hardly necessary. The run-down old building held no significance to the mimic other than being a quiet spot where it could focus on its work.
"We heading out soon?"
"After sunset,"
Boxy said, setting down the heavy bag it was carrying around. Now that it was away from prying eyes, the mimic quickly undid its human-like transformation and assumed its favorite spider chest form. Having to keep its real body tilted on its side all day while masquerading as a person was considerably uncomfortable and slightly disorienting. It had gotten used to it over the last week, but it much preferred its spider legs after all.
"What's all this?"
asked Cora, pointing at the sack.
"Parts. What about the intruders you mentioned?"
"Hmm? Oh, yeah. Just some pathetically weak bums. One of them keeled over the instant he saw me. No fun at all."
The fiend pouted slightly to indicate her displeasure, but her master completely ignored her and skittered over to the bodies. It hadn't gotten a chance to eat anything worthwhile all day, so it wasted no more time fulfilling that basic need. The dead men were thus quickly devoured, and any bloodstains were instantly licked up out of habit. These pathetic weaklings were better utilized as food rather than trying to absorb them. Even then, they were mostly skin and bones and wouldn't be nearly enough to satiate Boxy's monstrous hunger, but they would at least keep its belly from rumbling for the moment. The mimic then went back to the sack it brought in and opened it. 3 metal toolboxes were retrieved from the inside, a gray one, a red one, and a blue one. They were approximately 30 centimeters wide, while their length and height were just over half that. The containers looked like miniature chests, which the mimic found to be oddly endearing. Maybe even a little bit cute. It put the red and blue ones inside its storage and opened up the gray one using 2 of its spider legs as elongated fingers. A number of smaller boxes and compartments lined the inside, each holding a number of metallic bits necessary for handheld artificer devices.
"Oh!"
exclaimed Cora.
"You're building stuff again, huh? Can I watch?"
"Okay."
Boxy sat firmly on the ground and narrowed its focus. Its 8 arachnid limbs were not retracted inside its body, however, but bent forward towards the toolbox. The 4 at the very front had their pointed tips split in 2 as if they were organic tweezers with chitin-like tips. The mimic then applied its recently acquired metal mimicry skill to the other 4. Pliable flesh transformed into actual solid steel, as opposed to merely an imitation of it, forming an array of tools in the process. More specifically, a hammer, a pair of wire cutters, and 2 screwdrivers. 2 of the tweezer-like fingers each grabbed a part from the toolbox and held them in place while 2 of the tool-tipped limbs put them together. The other set of tools and pincers did the same, then the 1st repeated their action. The 8 stick-like limbs began moving about frantically, gradually picking up in speed, though hardly at the expense of precision. In a way, the practiced movements made the whole thing look too easy. It was almost as if the monster was simply throwing the bits into a pile that miraculously assembled itself into something new all on its own. This spectacle was nothing special from the mimic's point of view, though. It was just employing a combination of its magical perception, muscle memory, and dexterity attribute to make sure everything went exactly where it needed to be. That was why it barely showed a reaction when it accomplished its task in seemingly no time flat.
"You have created a blade blossom of great quality."
"Huh, that's neat,"
commented Cora. By now, her boredom from standing guard all day had gone away. The fiend found watching her master work to be surprisingly fun. Even if she had no idea what was going on, it was hard to deny that seeing something assembled before her very eyes at high speeds was quite entertaining. She would, of course, much prefer to go on a murder spree with a healthy dose of rape, but beggars couldn't be choosers. As for the mimic, it had already moved on to the next item. It had learned quite a few things from Fizzy's day-long crash course, so it was eager to become a level 5 artificer in order to put that knowledge to use. Its job level was very close to that threshold, but it still needed to make 10 or so more of these relatively basic contraptions before it reached that goal. You have created a blade blossom of superior quality. Just like Fizzy had informed it at the beginning, this job increased in level much slower than what the mimic was used to. The reason was that instead of being a monster job like mimic or a caster such as warlock, the artificer job was of the artisan archetype. This meant that one had to repeatedly manufacture related items or perform relevant services in order to gain XP. It was impossible to grow as an artificer just by killing things, regardless of whether the monster used those blade blossoms in combat or not. You have created a blade blossom of standard quality. Well, it made sense in a way. It wasn't like a villager would become a better farmer if he went about hitting people over the head with his radishes. He had to work the fields, care for livestock, and churn butter. Blacksmiths had to make, maintain, and improve weapons and armor, and cooks had to make lots of delicious food. What happened with said items, or whether anyone would eat that food, did not matter as far as the job was concerned. And an artificer was no different. You have created a blade blossom of great quality. Therefore, raising a production job was a naturally slow, arduous process. The only upside was that the relative speed of progress stayed mostly constant as it got further along. In other words, it took roughly the same amount of time to get from level 1 to level 5 as it did to get from level 50 to level 55. However, that was only under the condition that one had the right materials and sufficiently advanced schematics to keep pushing their limits. The relatively simplistic Blade Blossoms, for example, would stop providing XP once Boxy's artificer job hit level 5, and it would need to move on to something more challenging. Much like how combat-oriented jobs would not grow properly if one only fought the same type of low-level enemy, artisan jobs required their own set of level-appropriate challenges in order to improve. It wouldn't be called progression if one endlessly ran in place, after all. You have created a blade blossom of great quality. Well, this particular individual's monstrous crafting speed was the main reason it had advanced much faster than Corny Fizzlesprock had anticipated. The gnome assumed her student was a human, which was why she freaked out at its growth earlier. While it wasn't exactly unheard of for geniuses in certain fields to appear from time to time, seeing one right before her eyes was something she never thought would happen. In fact, her initial assumption had been that it was far more likely her student progressed so fast because he cheated. You have created a blade blossom of superior quality. Which wasn't far from the truth, considering Boxy's multiple-tooled limbs, its extremely accurate three-dimensional magical perception, and impressive dexterity attribute score. It could assemble a blade blossom in under 3 minutes, which was 3 or 4 times faster than what its gnomish teacher was capable of. A regular beginner, on the other hand, would probably take over an hour of slow, meticulous work to make a single one. And even then, whether it would actually result in a satisfactory product was highly questionable. You have created a blade blossom of standard quality. Physical capabilities were hardly the entire reason for this level of efficiency, however. It was also a matter of the mimic's mindset. It equated the work of artificers to be shapeshifting applied to an object. Both practices boiled down to combining basic elements into something that was greater than the sum of its parts. The only difference from the mimic's point of view was that one used flesh and bone while the other relied on springs and sprockets. You have created a blade blossom of great quality. In truth, Boxy found the act of assembly was actually much, much simpler than shapeshifting its body around. Growing a working human eyeball for the first time or creating an organic wheel from scratch was, objectively speaking, already far more complex than something straightforward like a spring-loaded blade dispenser. And once it had gotten used to the creation process, its naturally adept muscle memory could reconstruct its creations with ease. Even the organic wheels took less than 2 seconds to form by now, thanks to all the practice it put into them. Thus, assembling a contraption of this small scale and basic function was a trifling task at best. Another thing that spoke volumes of its ability was that its creations were of a higher quality than normal. You have created a blade blossom of standard quality. Well, most of the time anyway. It was only natural that handmade items would come out with some variations between them. An errant twitch from the craftsman, some misstep in the timing, or an unseen flaw in the components and materials could all cause the quality to deteriorate. Conversely, performing the right motions with high-grade materials would result in a fittingly superior product. Fizzy was, to her credit, an adept craftsman, so Boxy rarely came across a situation where it was let down by faulty parts. It wasn't experienced enough to tell when such a thing happened, but it understood that, statistically speaking, it must have happened several times so far. It saw no other reason why its creations would drift between the standard and great quality ratings. It was definitely showing improvement, though, as evidenced by how it would get a superior quality blade blossom every now and then. You have created a blade blossom of poor quality. The opposite outcome was also possible, though. The mimic had tried to make one a bit quicker than normal, which resulted in its product being given the second lowest quality rating. At the very least, it wasn't the dreaded unusable, as items of this absolute bottom rank were unsalvageable trash. In fact, according to Fizzy, unusable items were so bad it was safer to bury them in a ditch instead of trying to use them in combat. Her words of warning went double for artificer-made goods, as those had a habit of backfiring if mishandled. This was all very informative to Boxy, as the simple creature had no idea what any of those terms meant, nor how many tiers of this stuff existed. It vaguely understood that superior was better than great, which was, in turn, better than standard, and so on, but that was the gist of it. As a monster that was predisposed to relying on its natural gifts rather than crafted equipment, it had some difficulty grasping the concept of gear quality. The world would honestly be much easier to understand if everything was graded on tastiness and shininess instead.
I have returned,
reported Zira as she walked into the old office. Boxy was working on its 10th creation of the afternoon when its other familiar reappeared. The succubus was still disguised as a nun in service to Teresa, the goddess of justice and truth whose religious symbolism revolved around hammers. The delicious irony of that form was the main reason she chose to use it. The secondary reason was that it enticed her demonic co-contractor to perform far more brutal acts upon her person during their intimate sessions. The tertiary, and objectively legitimate, incentive was that people treated her with less suspicion and more respect than they normally would have.
Oh, hey, Cumbucket,
said Cora when she saw the succubus arrive.
Hey, what's our master doing?
Asked Zira, pointing at Boxy.
The boss is building more of those metal flowers. Oh? Let me see.
The false nun got closer to the mimic and looked curiously at its tooled limbs as they swished around in a blur. It was the first time she'd bothered to get a proper look at the process, and she had to admit it looked pretty impressive.
Huh, that's neat,
Zira commented with a bemused smile.
I know, right? I really hope it finishes its business with the gnome soon, though. My Dreamweaver skill is bound to mess something up if I have to keep using it on the same target.
Best-case scenario, the gnome would become a complete amnesiac or fall into a coma. Worst-case scenario, all the memories that were locked away would come crashing back and the monstrous trio's cover would be blown wide open.
What's that gnome like, anyway? Haven't seen anything but dark alleys and homeless bums for the past week. She looks like a little kid, with a large head and pink pigtails. A kid, huh? How tall are we talking?
About this big.
The succubus used her hand to indicate the gnome only went up to about her midsection, just below the breasts. The difference between the two was almost as extreme as the difference between Zira and Cora.
Say, do you think if I stuck my dick in all the way it would come out of her throat?
That's not how anatomy works, you moron.
It isn't?
Of course not. Mortals have all those mushy organs in their torsos, remember? Spleens, hearts, stomachs, livers.
Stop that! You're making me hungry,
Boxy called out before returning to its tinkering.
Oh, yeah, those,
said Cora, stroking her chin in thought.
I can just push past those with enough force, though, right?
What?
Zira blurted.
But Oh, I see. Well, I guess that could work.
You just got turned on at the thought of being speared all the way through by a massive dick, didn't you?
No? Well, maybe a little.
Cora raised an eyebrow.
Uh-huh.
Okay, a lot.
You really want to be dicked to death, huh?
Like you wouldn't believe. You really should look into growing a bigger-
I said be quiet!
The mimic mind shouted, causing both demons to shut up. Their constant prattling was easy to ignore normally, but what Boxy needed to do right now was concentrate, and listening to those two flirting was really not helping in that regard. Having no other choice in the matter, the two demons decided to settle down and observe the monster's handiwork.
You have created a Blade Blossom. Level up. Congratulations, you are now a level 5 Artificer. Dexterity plus 2, Wisdom plus 2, Perception plus 2. Proficiency level increased. Clockwork Expertise is now level 1. Dexterity plus 2, Perception plus 2.
Knowledge of gears, cogs, sprockets, and springs poured into the mimic's mind. Now it could finally build something other than those entry-level blade blossoms. Clockwork Expertise. A measure of an artificer's ability to handle and construct clockwork-based gadgets and gizmos. Requirements: Level 5 Artificer. Type: Passive. Range: Self. Effects: Grants knowledge of clockwork-based creations. Increases the effectiveness of clockwork-based creations by 5% per level of this skill. As for the skill itself, the reason it appeared immediately was because that was another way in which artisan jobs differed from combat-oriented occupations. Their related skills were acquired automatically at set levels, and there was no choice involved in terms of specialization. At least until level 50, at which point Boxy would be able to evolve the artificer job into one that was better suited to its needs. Another quirk the mimic learned about jobs during its stay here was that none of them granted additional skills at the so-called threshold levels of 25, 50, and 75. Reaching the absolute highest level of 100, however, would unlock a superbly powerful ultimate skill that was uniquely suited to the individual. That sounded so incredibly tasty that it caused Boxy to salivate like crazy every time it remembered that piece of trivia. As for exactly why skills were limited at those three specific levels, it was unknown. The information Zira had dug up suggested this was simply the way of things. Boxy had more or less accepted that fact, as neither its mimic nor its warlock job offered it a new skill upon reaching level 25. So it was not surprised to find out the artificer one would be the same. Now that its immediate objective was complete, the mimic turned its attention to Zira.
Snack! What did you find?
The demoness was under orders to keep looking for information or items that the mimic deemed necessary. The fact she had returned meant she must have found something.
I have acquired one of the materials you needed for your ritual, Master.
Boxy's mood shot up upon hearing those words.
Give it to me!
Yes, Master.
The succubus, still masquerading as a nun, stood in front of the mimic and lifted up the hem of her habit. She rolled it up past her knees, up her thighs, and all the way to the hips. It should come as no surprise that the perverted demon was not wearing anything under it, as evidenced by how her nether region was on full display. She moaned. Her abdominal muscles tightened, and then a small black sphere about 5 centimeters in diameter came out of her exposed lower lips. It bounced twice along the filthy wooden floor and rolled slowly towards the mimic, stopping only a few centimeters from where it was sitting. The gem-like ball was oddly shiny, and not just because it was covered in Zira's juices. The fake nun straightened out her habit and looked at her master with slightly glazed eyes.
One holy pearl infused with demonic essence as requested, Master.
Very good!
Exclaimed Boxy. If sentient chests could smile, then that was undoubtedly what Boxy was trying to do with that toothy look it had. This was very good indeed. All that was left was to obtain a midnight ruby, an elixir of avarice, and then wait for a night where all three moons were in the sky, and it could finally perform the enticingly titled Ritual of Unholy Wealth. Part 4. After stowing away the once pure holy pearl, Boxy turned its attention back to the gray toolbox on the floor. It opened its maw and retrieved the blue toolbox from earlier, setting it down next to the other and unlatching the lid. This one also had numerous bits and pieces, although the majority of them were various sizes of cogs, sprockets, and gears, complete with some wound springs, an assortment of tiny screws, and a collection of small metal plates. Just the right ingredients to build designs that relied on clockwork expertise. The last remaining toolbox it bought from Fizzy, the red one, held the ingredients and components for creating explosives, although that would have to wait until Artificer Level 10. Cora and Zira watched in silence as their master prepared its mini-tooled limbs and once more began assembling a new device. However, this was something vastly different from the blade blossoms it had mass-produced until now. To begin with, the metal plate that would serve as the base of the contraption wasn't circular, but rectangular, and it was significantly larger at about 15 centimeters long and 3.5 centimeters wide. The mimic's hands also moved much slower than before as it punched a few holes into the thin plate and started screwing gears into it. The reason for the loss in speed was simple. This was its first time handling these delicate components seriously. It did get some practice working with clockwork contraptions in its teacher's workshop earlier, but that was while using the clumsy fingers of a human. Clockwork expertise also helped, but that skill only granted theoretical knowledge. Boxy always learned faster by doing than by thinking, so it made sure to take things slowly until it felt more confident in its actions. Still, it wasn't like it didn't listen to Fizzy's instructions. Quite the contrary, it absorbed every little insightful detail she revealed, either through her words or actions. Where to apply pressure, how much of it to use, what parts needed additional grease, how much strain the delicate gears could take before their teeth broke, and other useful tips that could only be gleaned from years of experience. As for the skill-derived knowledge, that had mostly to do with schematics and blueprints rather than any practical advice. Proficiency level increased. Metal mimicry is now level 3. Strength plus 2. Endurance plus 2. All attributes plus 1. Working with new parts also demanded new tools. And while it did technically pay good money for those, it could produce far better results by forming them out of its own body. It couldn't exactly maintain its sense of touch once turning its flesh to steel, but using instruments directly connected to its nervous system was definitely the superior approach. It was a level of manual dexterity that no human, dwarf, or gnomish artificer could hope to match, no matter how high their attributes or levels climbed. Speaking of which, the mimic had made an interesting observation ever since the calamity of Monotol. It appeared that, on average, skills acquired at higher job levels provided additional attributes whenever they went up in proficiency. This realization made the mimic feel scammed in that respect, since it had already used one of its very limited unlock points on a level 1 skill instead of a level 30 skill. Then again, missing out on attributes wasn't that big a deal when it had cadaver absorption on hand to fill the gap. Now was not the time to get complacent, however. Boxy had been spying on a team of adventurers in the field, and what it saw was worrisome. Those 4 people were said to have attained level 60 recently, which was comparable to the mimic's total job level, and yet they completely outperformed it. Not only was their teamwork something else entirely, but each individual was also immensely powerful. That was when Boxy realized the biggest, most damning difference between itself and individual adventurers. Their gear. Magic weapons, sturdy armor, enchanted jewelry, and potent potions. Each item they had provided them with some attribute bonus or other special effect that allowed them to fight toe-to-toe with physically superior monsters. This was why the mimic had resolved to obtain gear of its own. Those 2 shiny daggers it got off the Dungeon Master were a start, but there were only so many things that would let themselves be stabbed to death. However, when Boxy set about fulfilling its new goal, it immediately ran into its first hurdle. Enchanted gear cost money. A lot of money. Money, aside from being shiny, could also be exchanged for goods and services. That was simply how civilized society worked. And although the monster had some starting capital, it wouldn't be nearly enough for its needs. Of course, it could always attempt to loot said magical equipment off the adventurer's dead bodies, But would it really survive an encounter with them? No. No, it would not. It had complete confidence it would lose if it ever had to fight that particular team, regardless of whether or not it got a successful ambush off. And so it found the Mercenary Guild and started taking on quests. Its initial monetary reserve swelled to about 2,400 GP, and then it went shopping. Potions were easy enough to obtain from merchants and peddlers. In fact, the Mimic currently had 10 of them in storage, although they were of varying quality. The 4 most potent ones it had could instantly restore up to 300 HP, but were also quite expensive at 190 GP apiece. What's with that stupid price? 50 HP potions only cost 16 GP each, had been the creature's initial reaction to that seemingly exorbitant price tag. As it turned out, the vast majority of alchemical products had undesirable side effects. After all, the difference between medicine and poison was mostly in the dosage, and magical liquids were no exception. Consuming too many potions in a short amount of time would inflict a condition known as potion sickness. Exactly how much a body could take varied between individuals, and the Mimic found out its limit was 5 potions per day. Any more than that, and its body would be racked with immense pain, its movements would grow dull and sluggish, and it would suffer a penalty to its attributes. This lasted for almost 6 hours before its body could recover from the built-up toxicity. Having experienced this with its own body helped Boxy realize why higher quality potions were so much more expensive. One could only rely on a very limited number of alchemical elixirs during a fight, so quality was far more valuable than quantity. Buying the good stuff also meant that the Mimic's gold reserves took a big hit, but it wasn't too upset about that, since being poor and alive was preferable to being rich and dead. Having solved its medication needs, the shapeshifter moved on to check out the prices of enchanted arms and armor. It visited 5 stores, each of which advertised selling mid-range adventurer gear. It didn't see a single piece that was cheaper than 800 GP. There was even a really fancy-looking set of armor that had a 5-digit price tag, though Boxy did its best to ignore the actual numbers. Not only was that amount clearly beyond its means, but it feared it might be traumatized if it looked at it directly. Overall, the window shopping spree had taught the monster 2 things. The good news was that the mithril daggers and enchanted knife it already had looked to be of decent make and would net it a mouth-watering 1,200 GP if it sold them. It wasn't about to pawn off its shiniest belongings, but that information was good to know. The bad news was that the most vital piece of equipment, namely armor, was out of the question. It wasn't just the cost. That could easily be resolved if Boxy put enough work in with the Mercenary Guild. But most armor was made to fit people, not chests. Oh, sure, the Mimic was capable of disguising itself as one, but that was still just a facade made of flesh. It was an unfamiliar form that was extremely awkward to fight in as it played havoc with the sentient chest's sense of balance and direction. Just walking around was difficult enough, so combat was out of the question entirely. Any enemy that could be defeated by that shape's awkward flailing would hardly be considered as an opponent that required magical equipment. And that was when Boxy found out about artificers. About how they could build unorthodox weapons and gear that seemingly ignored standard conventions. Transforming shields, repeating crossbows, multi-purpose projectile launchers, metal boots that allowed flight, gadgets that rendered one invisible, weapons that outright shot lightning. The list of fascinating inventions went on and on and on. But perhaps the most alluring part of that profession was the ability to create truly original works that were custom-tailored to fit the needs of their creator. Even if said creator was a violent box with a penchant for sticking pointy objects into fleshy things. Of course, Boxy was intrigued by this job. Using cheap tricks and unexpected maneuvers to confuse and befuddle its opponent was its way of life, so the possibilities it saw within the artificer job were truly delicious. Granted, most of this information it got second-hand from Zira, but it could easily confirm the details if it visited the best, and only, artificer trainer in the city. Which was how it met Corny Fizzlesprocket and obtained the artificer job from her for a fee. All in the same day. Well,
It also had to have her memory wiped since it got overexcited and licked her face with a clearly inhuman 1-meter-long tongue, but that was beside the point. However, it would appear that making original designs from scratch was well out of the moronic chest's current abilities. It didn't even know how screws, nuts, and bolts even worked, let alone gears, springs, or magnets. To say it had gone in over its lid was an understatement. Thankfully, the artificer job and its derived skills would grant the knowledge and expertise necessary to create all those wondrous devices Boxy had heard about. Provided the monster put in the time, effort, and resources to raise them properly, of course. This course of action was precisely what the Mimic was currently engaged in. A future where it could unleash all manner of deadly contraptions on its foes was a tremendous source of motivation. Plus, it found the act of tinkering to be uniquely tasty. These two reasons were why the only noises that could be heard throughout the abandoned warehouse's old office for the past hour were the clacking and scraping sounds of an artificer immersed in their work. And the fruits of that labor took shape as a metal dagger handle with a slot where the blade should be. You have created a retractable blade of poor quality. The name of the thing was indicative of its function. Boxy opened its mouth and a pale humanoid arm stretched out of it. The retractable blade was then partially absorbed by this arm, sinking into the skin just above the wrist. And then the Mimic activated it by triggering the small switch hidden inside the out-of-place limb's skin. A 10-centimeter-long steel blade popped out just above its wrist and over its knuckles.
Holy shit! Whoa! Hey, that's pretty cool!
The two demons that had been sitting quietly until now let out surprised voices. Zero was momentarily startled, while Cora was actually impressed. Of course, they saw the assembly start to finish, but they had no idea what this blade in a box was supposed to actually do until they saw it with their own eyes. The blade disappeared as quickly as it had appeared, although it failed to retract fully on the first try. As one would expect from a poor quality item, it had some glaring defects. Boxy thought this was a good start, though, as its main goal here was increasing its artificer levels. It hardly mattered if the retractable blade was crappy, as the monster could achieve a far superior result if it put its metal mimicry to use. It had no intention of putting the thing to use, but the curious box still wondered how effective a weapon it actually was. Luckily, it had just the test subject on hand to help it find out.
"Snack, come over here and stand still," it commanded.
The succubus, having no choice in the matter, did as ordered and stood before her master while still disguised as a nun. She had a pretty good idea of what was about to happen, so she was unabashedly looking forward to this next bit. And indeed, just as she'd deduced, her master swung that freakish arm towards her chest. She envisioned a scenario where the blade would pop out at the last moment and strike into her with added momentum and force. You have suffered a deep wound. HP minus 122. Which was precisely what had happened. The specially designed iron blade skewered her left breast and pierced her torso. If she had a heart, it would undoubtedly be stabbed clean through. But since she didn't, she could just revel in the delicious sensations of being penetrated by something long and hard. Boxy, on the other hand, was slightly disappointed. This amount of damage was quite terrible. Was it because this weapon wasn't a dagger, technically speaking? They were somewhat similar, but very different at the same time, so it was possible that its dagger mastery did not apply in this case. Or maybe the reason for this subpar performance was because the device was of shoddy make? The Mimic briefly thought back on the last hour and remembered that it slightly bent the main linchpin during assembly. That was probably why the knife couldn't be reeled in, and also why there was a small time lag between the trigger being pressed and the blade popping out. The rookie artificer figured it might as well take the thing apart and see if it messed up anything else. However, attempting to pull the weapon out of the demon's torso caused it to break off, leaving the succubus with a large metal fragment sticking out of her left boob. Well, that wasn't supposed to happen. But it did anyway. Boxy had shaved away too much material from the brace that connected the handleless knife to the rest of the contraption, which snapped under the sudden strain.
Ah!
As for Zira, she was understandably still in pain. And she was also, albeit less understandably, still enjoying it. That was when the mimic had a flash of inspiration. It made a fist and punched the succubus in her wound, driving the blade even farther inside her. Your target has suffered internal injury. Target HP minus 71. The demon fell over backwards, screaming, her mostly decorative blood flying everywhere. The mimic loomed over her, holding one of the cheaper healing potions it had. The succubus looked up at it in between wails of pain and pleasure, but had no idea what was about to happen. Surely that selfish master of hers wasn't about to heal her in this situation. Right? Contrary to her expectations, though, that was precisely what happened. Boxy poured the magical liquid directly onto the wound. Doing so instead of drinking it would concentrate the potion's effect on that part of the body, restoring less HP overall but instantly treating critical injuries. It looked as if the knife-eared alchemist that sold it the magical medicine had been telling the truth, as the bleeding gash was sealed within the blink of an eye. With the foreign object still inside. The test subject started screaming her lungs out. These were no longer lustful half-moans brought on by one's kink, but the wailing of a woman being tortured. She thrashed about wildly as the magical liquid tried to make her body bond with the metal blade that clearly didn't belong to it. Her HP didn't take any damage, but the pain she felt was like every nerve in her chest was on fire. Another tip that old alchemist gave Boxy was to make sure that no foreign objects like shards of glass or arrowheads remained in the open wound before applying a potion directly to it. The mimic wasn't sure how that mattered until it witnessed the results for itself. Drinking the concoction normally would cause the healing effect to work from the inside out, causing any foreign objects to be pushed out of the body. However, using it directly on the injury would have the opposite effect, resulting in what Zira was currently going through.
"Stand up!" commanded the mimic.
The wailing succubus made an effort to follow this order, but every single movement caused bolts of pain to shoot through her chest, all the way into the back of her head. The white-hot sensation made her stumble over and fall down to the ground, which only aggravated her condition. She continued wailing like a banshee that was having all her teeth and nails pulled out simultaneously, and seemed physically incapable of fulfilling Boxy's directions. The mimic was quite satisfied with this outcome. It had no idea that a disposable blade and a cheap potion could produce a result like that, but wasn't about to complain. It made a mental note of this combination, as it could very well be used to disable an opponent in the future. Whether it could actually pull off such a thing in the heat of combat was another question entirely, but it was good to have options. Your familiar has been dismissed. Having finished its impromptu experiment, the mimic sharpened its focus and forcibly dismissed its familiar, causing both her screaming and thrashing to cease immediately. Zira's now lifeless physical form disappeared within seconds, as did any bodily fluids she left behind. All that was left of her was the broken-off retractable blade. The mimic nonchalantly picked it up and examined it. It was still in near-pristine condition, so it could undoubtedly be reused. Satisfied, it sat back down in its little work area, resummoned the succubus, and went about dismantling the rest of its first clockwork-based gadget. Cora, having watched the whole ordeal, was more than a little disturbed. Even if she wasn't as susceptible to pain as her co-contractor, she seriously doubted whether she could bear that. Yet she was still somewhat curious whether she could handle it, in a sort of, if there's a mountain, you have to climb it kind of way. However, even she wasn't stupid enough to ask her sadistic box of a master about that and was instead busy thanking her lucky stars it wasn't her turn to be used as a punching bag. In the end, she resolved to satisfy her morbid curiosity by questioning the one who had gone through it.
"Hey, Slagathor,"
she called out in a low voice. There was no way the succubus didn't hear her. Yet she showed no reaction and gave no response. She just kept staring absent-mindedly in the mimic's general direction. Cora naturally did not appreciate being ignored, so she exerted more effort in getting her fellow demon's attention.
"Oi! I'm talking to you!"
mostly by raising her voice and hitting her co-contractor across the face with a backhanded strike that was more of a punch than a slap.
Yes? What is it?
That seemed to do the trick as Zira looked away from the mimic and stared at the fiend. However, those glassy eyes, loopy grin, and silly way of speaking were completely unlike her.
You're acting weird. Weirder than normal, I mean,
Cora pointed out.
Did your rotten head break even further?
Hee hee hee. Maybe?
Zira answered in an uncharacteristically cheerful voice.
Okay, seriously. What's going on? Do I have to call Demons R Us?
It didn't matter to Cora how much physical torment her co-contractor went through, but the fiend would take action immediately if the succubus's immortal soul was in danger. No demon, no matter how depraved, insane, or selfish, would truly wish to see their fellow residents of the beyond disappear for good. And they got along much better than one would normally expect, so Cora's unusual show of concern was quite genuine.
Oh, no. Nothing like that,
Zira responded in a half-singing voice.
I had just forgotten how thorough my master can be.
This was the first time in a long while she had been abused to that extent. It was far more exhilarating than anything Cora had done to her. Of course, the fiend broke her bones and bruised her body during their extremely violent sessions, but she still held herself back, mostly because their master only allowed the two to engage in strictly non-lethal antics, but also because the red-skinned giantess was growing a little bit soft on her. Boxy, on the other hand, just saw her as a tool. A thing. It regarded her as nothing more than its possession, something to be used and thrown away as an owner saw fit. There was no doubt in the succubus's mind that the only reason she wasn't still writhing in agony on the floor was because Boxy wanted to retrieve its component from inside her. That, or she was simply being too noisy for its liking. Of course, the mimic didn't literally consider her as an inanimate object. It still understood that demons were living beings with thoughts, opinions, and emotions of their own. It just actively ignored that side of them until it became a problem. In Zira's opinion, although Cora's physical abuse was, for lack of a better word, quite tasty, the fiend paled in comparison to Boxy. Nothing could make the succubus's twisted heart race quite like the malicious neglect of her one and only master. Well, metaphorically speaking, at least.
I swear, you are getting creepier by the day,
Cora said. Zira did not respond. She simply kept staring at her master working on its little contraption while humming a random tune under her breath. Part 5. It could be said that the calamity of Monotol served as a sort of wake-up call for the Empire's complacent nobles. A good example of this was the Lord Mayor in charge of Erosa. In the past, he had been quite stingy with the city's defensive budget, although the same could be said of many of his peers. At least he was justified, in that Cradle Valley was a relatively peaceful place, far away from any external threats and with very few internal problems. However, his stance changed practically overnight when the grim rumors surrounding Monotol were confirmed to be true. Money was poured into the guardsmen responsible for Erosa's security. Equipment was ordered and delivered, salaries were raised, training was intensified, and recruitment drives were started. The Lord even went as far as authorizing so-called power-leveling expeditions for his guardsmen. This was a practice whereby a group of powerful adventurers would be paid to act as babysitters to one or more weaker individuals. These weaklings would attack strong monsters and inflict some modicum of damage, and the bodyguards would then swoop in and secure the kill. This method led to a dramatic increase in one's job level and any related attributes, but also came with a downside. The power leveler would be left with their skills and weapon masteries woefully undeveloped. This created a very real problem that was referred to in the adventurer community as hollow power. It meant that an individual whose strength had been coddled rather than forged through their own merits would lead them astray. They would grow overconfident and arrogant without having the basic abilities, combat experience, or battle sense to back them up. There were, of course, those who sought to actively rectify this flaw and fill in the gaps, but they were often few and far between. So while power leveling was effective in rapidly increasing one's martial or mystical might, it was quite frowned upon by veteran adventurers, who were also, ironically enough, the only ones who could reliably fulfill such requests. However, the province was in a state of emergency. The Lord had to take drastic measures to make sure that not only was Erosa kept safe, but that its citizens also felt safe, and the local guild supported his policies. As a result, the city's security force experienced an explosive growth in both quantity and quality. Within the span of 10 days, it went from 200 guardsmen with an average level of 20 to 400 well-armed soldiers with a level of at least 35. This allowed patrols to be tightened and security checkpoints to be beefed up. There was even an anti-intrusion enchantment placed along the walls that would trigger an alarm should someone or something try to sneak in over them. It caused a few problems until it was calibrated to ignore most common birds, but that was a minor hiccup. There were, of course, more major hiccups. Many of the newly hired guards, for example, didn't particularly care for the people and simply wanted to get paid. There were even a few bad apples who tried their hand at smuggling or absconding with their issued weapons and armor, but they were quickly rooted out and punished accordingly. The overall result of this initiative was still positive in the short term. The commoners were reassured their taxes were being well spent, and the adventurer types that poured in from all over the country were less inclined to stir up trouble. It was too early to tell if there had been any sort of effect on the crime rate, though that certainly didn't seem to be the case. While patrols within the city's walls increased, unrest also swelled with all the refugees and adventurers passing through. The slums were mostly ignored by law enforcement, and its residents were still treated as nothing more than a statistic. Nobody with any actual power would really notice or care if a bunch of them went missing. They were too busy focusing on new threats instead of dealing with existing ones. So while there was an overall heavier presence of guards within and around Erosa, it was mostly concentrated on the city's gates, walls, and main streets. And tonight was no different. There was a regiment of 14 guards standing at attention at the city's northern entrance, even though the sun had set long ago, and the vast majority of the town's population was fast asleep. 8 of them were on the outer side of the gatehouse, while the remaining 6 kept an eye on the inside. And one of those 6 noticed a pair of shadows approach his position from the darkened street.
"Who goes there?" he called out.
His colleagues immediately raised their guard at his words. The area around the gate was bathed in the warm yellow light of the torches, but it was still hard to make out people's faces until they got closer.
"It is I, my child,"
called out the smaller silhouette with a clear, calming voice. The image of a humble nun in service to the goddess Teresa gradually became clearer with every step she made. She wore a plain, dark gray habit with the image of a small golden hammer embroidered on either shoulder. Her face was easy on the eyes, and although she looked to be in her early 20s, she carried herself with an undeniable sense of grace and humility.
"Ah, Sister Lyo,"
said the guard after he recognized her.
"Going out to gather moon blossoms again?"
"Indeed, my child. I am afraid the orphan in my care is still suffering from night terrors."
Moon blossoms were an herb said to bestow sweet dreams on anyone who drank tea made from its petals. The catch was that the flower withered quickly and, as suggested by its name, only bloomed under the moonlight. Therefore, it was perfectly reasonable for one to gather the herb after dark if they hoped to make use of its sleep-inducing properties.
"And, Mr. Tall, Dark, and Gruesome there will be your escort?"
The guard pointed at the person following behind the nun. He was a heavy-set man who stood at over 2 meters in height. The heavy cloak he wore concealed both his face and his body. The suspicious-looking individual didn't speak, merely nodding his head deeply in response to the guard's inquiry.
"That is so,"
confirmed the nun.
"Are you certain you will be fine with just him?"
"Do not fret, my child. He is most capable."
"Well, yeah. I know it's not the first time you've hired him, but I can't help but worry sending you out there with a shady guy like that."
"I appreciate your concern, but please be at ease. I trust my dear cousin with my life."
"Ah, Your cousin, is it?
If the good sister said it was so, then it must have been the truth. After all, she was one of the devout servants of Teresa, the goddess of truth and justice.
Apologies, Sister Lyo. I just can't help but worry. I heard about the break-in at the temple.
Someone had snuck into the local temple of Teresa and absconded with one of the holy pearls kept there. Pretty much the entire city knew by now, even though the heinous act had only come to light this afternoon.
Indeed, a very horrid affair,
said the nun with a hint of sadness in her voice.
I pray the misguided soul who took that sacred treasure will see the light of her truth and beg for her forgiveness.
The nun raised her right hand up to her face and pressed the tips of her middle and index fingers to her lips, forehead, and left breast in turn. Many of the guards present there repeated the religious gesture. Its meaning could be loosely interpreted as, "Let my mouth speak only the truth that resides within my mind and heart." The well-meaning guard then ordered the rest to make way for the devout nun and her companion. They guided them respectfully through the heavily guarded door on the side of the gate and kept a watchful eye on them as they made their way into the darkness that lay beyond the city's walls.
I don't like that guy,
one of the men stationed outside the wall said to his older colleague once the two travelers were out of sight.
Yeah, I know, agreed his fellow watchman. Gives me the creeps, you know.
What? Oh, yeah, I guess there's that too.
Huh? What were you talking about then?
Nothing much. Just a bit jealous, I suppose.
You are? Of what?
I mean, he gets to spend time with a cute girl like that for the night. You know how it is. Just the two of them. Under a moonlit sky. Away from prying eyes.
The other guy raised his hand, gesturing for his colleague to shut up.
I am going to pretend I didn't just hear you insinuate that Sister Lyo is having an immoral tryst with her cousin.
How do you know they haven't done it?
Because, you idiot, that's fucking sick. Not only that, but there's no way one of Teresa's faithful would break their oath of celibacy.
Swearing to maintain one's chastity wasn't a practice that was as widespread as it used to be, but it was still very common among the human-dominated Lodrak Empire's clergy. The ones in Erosa were no exception.
Yeah? And how would you know Sister Lyo hasn't done it?
Because Teresa's the goddess of truth.
Yeah, so?
So? Do you honestly think she'd let anyone get off easy if they dared break an oath made in her holy name? They'd get branded with the taboo skill for sure.
The effects of that skill were, simply put, to alienate the bearer from all religious orders and pious believers. It was basically the god's way of marking those who actively and knowingly went against their will. It was pretty much a death sentence in some of the more fanatical corners of the world.
Oh, right,
said the younger guard.
That was a thing, wasn't it?
He vaguely remembered hearing something like that from his mum, but he had forgotten about it since he wasn't a particularly religious guy. He had far more important things to worry about than some far-off gods, like putting food on the table, or finding an apothecary to treat that weird boil on his bum.
Hey, you lot!
Called out someone from on top of the gatehouse.
Be quiet down there and pay attention. If someone or something sneaks past us, it'll be on all our heads.
Yes, sir,
replied the two undisciplined guards as they resumed their duties. Tensions were indeed high since the calamity of Monotol, so they could not afford to be careless. That was the whole point of all the beefed-up security measures in the first place. Which was more than a little ironic, since the creature responsible for that disaster had just slipped by them anyway. Actually, it was more accurate to say that it had slipped under them. As it turned out, all the guards and magical security systems were no match for a mimic with a penchant for digging and too much free time on its hands. Or was that tentacles? Tongues? Legs, maybe? Regardless of Boxy's confusing anatomy, it had simply made a tunnel that went under the western section of the wall. The entrance was near its hideout in the slums, and the exit was some distance away from the wall, impossible to spot at a distance. Of course, the heavy security measures weren't in place when the mimic first got there, and it could leisurely climb over the wall. But that was then. This was now. Attempting something like that after the detection enchantment had been placed was sure to cause an alarm. Trying to get past the security checkpoints was also quite problematic. The monster seriously doubted whether it had the people skills to not make them suspicious of its true nature, so it opted to avoid them entirely. Granted, the subterranean route wasn't its only option. There was also the possibility of infiltrating the city by walking along the bottom of the Whispering Canal. The deep, narrow river provided Erosa with fresh drinking water and ran right through the center of the city. Going through the drains built into the city's thick stone walls was an obvious choice, but Boxy had to give up on that path. The water was crystal clear for the most part, so anyone and anything would be able to spot it moving along the bottom. There was also the very real worry of running out of breath. The fact that the wall's submerged drainpipe had not one, not two, but a series of four metal grates protecting it had very little to do with Boxy's decision to avoid that place, okay? Having passed through its tunnel, the mimic emerged into the night under the cover of darkness. Since the west side of the city wall had no gates, it only had to worry about the people patrolling on top of and around the wall. But the distance between them and it was already more than 60 meters. It also made sure to cover its faux wooden body in imitation grass and leaves in order to blend in with the knee-high grass that surrounded the plains to the west of the city. Boxy scuttled along towards the troll woods in the distance, but made a slight detour. It noticed a nun and her towering escort in the fields and decided to scout them out. It approached them silently under the cover of stealth in the surrounding tall grass. It stalked them for a bit, sizing them up and gauging whether it should pounce. The woman that was busy picking flowers didn't seem to be particularly threatening, but the mimic knew better than to underestimate the humans around these parts. Based on her religious vestments, it was very likely she was the holder of a priest job, although her level was more or less a complete mystery. Her escort was clearly a threat, however. Shining full plate could be seen under his cloak, while what was probably the handle of a greatsword stuck out from behind his head. He was obviously a close combat fighter, and although his level was equally unknown, he was giving off a very